The first speaker on the program, Brother Tom Ruggiero of Chicago. We heard him give a talk in New England a few years ago, and several members of the class were richly blessed. And so we believe that the message today will be also fruitful. The title is a little different than you would be customarily expect. The Faith of Purim. He wants, as an opening hymn, 186. So after the hymn, Brother Tom, would you please come to the platform.
Good morning, brethren. It's nice to be with you. I bring you the special love and greetings of your brethren in Chicago, especially my mother, Sister Sarah, and my wife, Sister Cheryl. We talk about faith quite often, don't we? When we look to the scriptures for examples of faith, we generally look to the men of the Bible. As their examples, we talk about Abraham, we talk about Moses and David and all their experiences and how faith was manifested in their lives. We saw how faith works differently in their lives. In Abraham, it worked in the offering of Isaac, almost a blind trust, never having known a resurrection before and yet believing that was the only way God could keep his promise. In Moses, we saw it with his desire to serve his people. His desire to, whatever the Lord wanted him to do, to go into a wilderness if necessary. So we saw faith manifested in different ways. But you know, the faith, basically, though, is still the same concept of heartfelt belief in God and then a conviction that comes from that belief. The more we examine faith, we talk about it so much and we study it and analyze it, we see that it's like a jewel that you can turn in the light. Those of you who are sitting in the sunlight could do that. You'd turn it and you'd see different colors come out of it, different manifestations of how it's exposed in our experiences. And I think that's why we're given so many examples in the scriptures of faith, because faith can be manifested in so many different ways, in so many different experiences in life. The experience of a sister working in a school, her faith is going to be manifested one way. The faith of a brother working in an engineering company may be manifested in another. A retired brother or sister, his faith or her faith are going to be manifested in a different way. It's the same concept of heart conviction and belief, but it's just a little different twist of the jewel, a little different color that might come through it. You know, the world talks about role models. The world sets up role models. And often the world's role models are the professional athlete or the actor or actress that they think the world should copy. But when we look at the world standard of what a role model should be, and we look at what the scriptures hold up as a role model, we see a totally different standard of what is good and what is not appropriate in role models. Well, that's really what the apostle was driving at in James 5:10 when he said, "Take my brethren the prophets who have spoken in the name of the Lord as an example, as a role model." The prophets, the men and women of the Bible, are the spiritual role models that the Lord is telling us to take in our lives. They're the ones that we're to hold up to our children as models that we want them to copy in their lives. Those who had faith in God, who exemplified that faith through whatever experience came in their life. But you know, we also need contemporary role models. Our lifestyles are so different than the lifestyle of the prophets of old, the wandering through the wilderness in the life conditions that they had. And so we need contemporary role models as well. Brethren, who have been some of your role models in life? Does anyone have a name you can just throw out?
Carl Hagensick.
Carl Hagensick. Boy, he's on my list. Anyone else? Brother Aaron? Brother Anton Fry.
Jesus.
Julius Panucci. Alpha Caterba. I think most of us have contemporary role models, don't we? I know I certainly have mine, and some of them are even still living. They're important because we need to see how faith is lived in our life form, our lifestyle, in the problems that come up in our lives that seem so different than the lives of the prophets. That's what Paul was telling Timothy in 1 Timothy 4:12. When he told him to set himself up as a role model for others, he said, "Be thou an example of the believers in word, in conversation, in love, in faith, and in purity." You know, a while ago I gave a discourse on faith, and I chose the traditional examples of Abraham, Moses, and David, because they're just such wonderful examples of manifestations of faith in life. But after that, a sister came to me and she says, "Why don't you speak on a sister's example of faith in the scriptures?" We need role models too. It's not just the brothers. I can't always identify with the lifestyle of Moses because I'm a sister in the 1990s. Well, that's why we've chosen the subject we have today. We're discussing one of the great women of faith in the scriptures. As you probably could tell from the title of the talk, we're going to be talking about the life of Esther. What I found, though, in looking at Esther's life is that faith really isn't any different, whether you're a man or a woman. The lessons of faith can be applied across the board. The difference of how faith is expressed in our lives, however, are different, as I said, according to the roles that you have in life. Part of faith is to accept the role that the Lord has given you in your life. And that's one of the big examples of Esther. She accepted the role as it came to her in her experiences. You know, a sister's experience in our contemporary day, and probably no different in the past, is that it's often easier for a sister to go to another sister for advice and counsel. I would think that it would be difficult for a sister to go to an elder or brother for advice, because you don't have that much in common. You have more in common with another sister. And so that's one of the roles that I believe the Lord has put in the church. Sisters counseling sisters. The mother counseling the daughter concept, I think, is important. Well, as I said, Esther's life was really largely designed for her. She had little choice regarding the position that she was put in. But she was able to use that position and become herself a hero of faith. Brethren, maybe it's been a while. I'm sure you all know the story of Esther, but let's just review it a little bit together. Esther was a Jewish orphan who lived in the Medo-Persian Empire. And since her parents were both dead, her official guardian became her older cousin, Mordecai. It's generally felt, this can't be proven, but it's generally felt that Esther was only 15 years old at the time of the experiences that we read about in the book of Esther. The story of faith in Esther, though, isn't just the story of Esther's faith. It's the intertwining of the faith of Esther and Mordecai. It really shows that parental relationship between father and daughter, even though he was a cousin. He really was, in essence, her spiritual father. There's a parental influence that Mordecai passed on to Esther, just like parents in the truth want to pass on their faith to their children. When it's properly done and it's accepted and the faith becomes the child's faith, not just the parent's faith, that's the way it's meant to work. That's the way the Lord designed it, the parent-child relationship. And it's beautiful when it works that way. You know, once I heard a politician answer a question put to him about how religious was he. And he gave a very political answer. He says, "Well, I'm very religious, but I just don't like to wear it on my shirt sleeve." And what I took him to mean was, "I'm religious because I want the religious votes, but I don't want to talk about it because I don't want to offend the non-religious voters or those who might be of a different religion." Well, Mordecai wasn't like that. Mordecai wasn't afraid to wear his religion on his sleeve. Religion was very relevant in Mordecai's life. It wasn't something to be avoided like the politician. And that example of faith was contagious. And to be contagious, it has to be worn in the daily life. It cannot be taken like an old hat and put in the closet in a hat box and only taken out on special occasions. Faith has to be exercised every day of our lives. That's what makes a person a hero of faith. It's not just the heroic times that faith has to be pulled out, but it's the daily use of faith in our everyday mundane experiences of life. Because the principle is when you're faithful in that which is least, in the common ordinary experiences of life, you will naturally then be faithful in the larger experience of life. Well, that's the legacy that Mordecai passed on to his adopted daughter Esther. So her faith structure was clearly built on the foundation that Mordecai helped to lay for her. Well, the story of Esther goes like this. Ahasuerus was king of the Medo-Persian Empire, and he held a feast for all the princes and nobles of his provinces. We're told there were 127 provinces in the empire, so it was a very large event. In fact, we're told that the feast lasted 180 days. 6 months of feasting. Now, these people knew how to party. And at the end of that time, they held another feast. It was a 7-day feast just for the people who worked in the palace of the king. And on the last day of that feast, Ahasuerus called for his queen Vashti and so that she would come and all the people could see her beauty. And all that we're told is Vashti refused to come. We're not told why. But on reprint 4900, Brother Russell speculates a little bit. He says that the people at that feast, being at the end, were probably all drunk. And it probably really gotten to be a wild event. And Vashti did not want to lower herself in dignity to the experiences that were going on there. So her refusal angered Ahasuerus. It says in chapter 1, verse 12, that the king's anger burned within him. And it says he immediately consulted his wise men. And their counsel was to put Vashti away, lest all the women in the empire see her example and do the same thing with their husbands, rebel against their authority. This is where Mordecai and Esther come in. Part of the proclamation was that a young virgin would be sought to take the place of Vashti as queen of the empire. Well, Mordecai was a servant in the palace of Ahasuerus. And so being from that household, Mordecai's family was sought to see if there was any eligible women who could be brought into king. Well, Esther apparently was eligible. In fact, she was probably extremely beautiful because as soon as the keeper of the women saw her, she said, "You're going to go into the king right away. Let's make preparations quickly and we'll take you in ahead of the others." Let's read Esther 2:17 to see the king's reaction when he first lays eyes on her. It says, "And the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her hand, her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. You know, brethren, in some ways the story reminds us of Joseph, doesn't it? His rise to power in the land of Egypt. Like Joseph, Esther was put in a position of power so that sometime in the future she could help her people. You know, it's a great blessing to know that the Lord has the ability to look into the future and to see problems that are going to arise and to begin the preparations for the solution of that problem, maybe years in advance. That's our first lesson of faith in this story. It's for us to realize that the Lord has the ability of foresight and that He uses it in our lives. That principle is so meaningful to the eye of faith as we look at world events around us today. Working behind the scenes, the Lord is preparing all the elements that are coming together for the establishment of the kingdom. You know, brethren, things in this world are not just taking their natural course, as so many in the world believe. There are forces that are battling for supremacy in the spiritual realm. As we see stories like Esther and like Joseph, we see the wisdom of God is working to prepare society for the traumatic events that have already happened and that are still yet to happen. As God deals with the powers in the world today, I believe that He brings in the right person at the right time, with the right education, with the right preparation to get an event going. Or He may even take someone off the scene who may have an idea that's just a little ahead of his time, or that isn't appropriate for the Lord's work. I believe the Lord is controlling things and playing it almost like a chess game, but not like a chess game where there's a chance He's going to lose. He knows there's no chance He's going to lose, but He's still working, pulling strings and doing things here and there to work out His plans. Dear brethren, we see that foresight in our own personal lives as well, don't we, from time to time. How many of us have said, you know, I really don't know why the Lord gave me this experience? And then maybe even years later, you look back on the experience and understand that there was a purpose future that the Lord was preparing you for and that He was bringing you into. It's His foresight, seeing your needs and seeing the experiences that would come up in your lives that He is preparing for even today. Once that lesson of God's foresight becomes a vital part of our faith, then we will be able to accept experiences that might have unknown lessons at the moment, but realizing that God's wisdom in bringing that lesson into our life is sure, that there is a good reason, even though we don't understand it right now. So our challenge is to dig for the lessons, to never be satisfied with just saying, well, there's a good reason, but to always try to strive to look for why God gave us that experience, always knowing that there is a good reason and a good purpose for allowing something in our lives. As the story of Esther goes on, it begins to involve Mordecai, Esther's cousin. Mordecai was a keeper of the gate. And that was a very crucial position for him to be in because he heard all the scuttlebutt, you might say, of what went on in the palace. A major turning point in Mordecai's relationship with Ahasuerus happens in the second chapter. Let's read Esther 2, verses 21 through 23. It says, "In those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door, were wrought and sought to lay hands on the king Ahasuerus. And the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it unto Esther the queen. And Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. And when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Therefore they were hanged on a tree, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king." Well, as I mentioned, this was to become a significant event later in the relationship between Mordecai and Ahasuerus. But for now, the plot was uncovered, the king's life was saved, and the thing was taken care of. The men were slain. Well, next on the scene comes a man named Haman. He had been promoted by Ahasuerus to be head of state as chief counselor. And with that promotion came a decree that everyone should bow and do reverence to Haman whenever he passed by. Mordecai had a problem with that. with bowing to him for various reasons, but for now we'll just say he refused to bow. And when Haman found out about that refusal, he was angry. In fact, we're told that he was so angry that killing Mordecai was not enough. Haman plotted to kill all Mordecai's people as well. Now, to me, that's an extreme reaction, because I don't think all the Israelites in general refused to bow. I think Mordecai specifically himself refused. But Haman's reaction was all the Jews had to die. Haman formed a plot against the Israelites. He consulted his diviners and he drew lots as to what would be the best day to slay Mordecai and the Israelites. That's where the celebration of Purim comes from. Purim means, it means lot. And so it's a commemoration of how God delivered Israel from the time that Haman drew lots to slay the Israelites. The faith of Purim was shown in how Esther and Mordecai trusted in the Lord's hand, and how they became willing instruments of the Lord's deliverance of Israel. Haman needed permission before he could carry out his plan. And he went to Ahasuerus, and he told the king that there was a race of people in the kingdom who did not keep the king's law, but kept a law of their own, which we know as the Mosaic Law. He advised the king that for his own benefit, these people should all be killed. And you know, it's like anything, when you put a certain twist on it, it sounds right, it sounds reasonable. We've seen kings in the past be tricked by someone who wanted something, didn't we? We saw that in the story of Daniel. Well, the king agreed that people should all be killed. The decree of Ahasuerus was actually written and dictated by Haman. And the date that they had drawn when they pulled the lots was determined that would be the date when they would kill all the Israelites. As it turned out, the drawing of the lots determined a date 11 months into the future. That was undoubtedly the Lord's providence, that 11 months would be picked, because that gave the Lord enough time to work out events for the deliverance of Israel. Here is where the faith of Mordecai and Esther made them ready servants for the Lord to use. When Mordecai hears the decree, he informs Esther. Notice what he says to her in chapter 4, verse 8. This is the middle of the verse. It says that he charged her that she should go in unto the king to make supplication unto him and to make request before him for her people. You know, brethren, this was a more difficult request than you might first think. Ahasuerus has been identified with the historical king Xerxes. On reprint 3657, Brother Russell describes some of the things that this king was known for. In one instance, as Xerxes was en route to a battle, he stopped in Phrygia. And there he was a guest of a certain rich man. And it was just a sumptuous feast. And at the end of the feast, the man comes to Ahasuerus and he says, you know, I have 5 sons who are in your army. Would you mind if my oldest son stayed back with his family? To me, that's a reasonable request. But Xerxes' reaction was to be outraged that he was tricked. This man had entertained him only because he wanted something. And so he took the son. He had him slain before his father. He had him cut in two. He had the 2 parts put on either side of the road, and he had his army march through it. There was another instance mentioned in that article where Xerxes allowed one of his previous queens to mutilate one of her rivals. You know, I picture Xerxes loving every minute of it. Let me just quote a sentence from that article. It says that her breasts, nose, lips, and ears were cut off and thrown to the dogs. Her tongue was torn out by the roots, and thus disfigured, she was sent home. Brethren, this was the cruelty of the man that Esther was asked to go in and ask a favor of. And if we know these stories about him, I don't think there's any doubt that everyone in the empire knew those stories. It was far greater what she was going to ask than what this man was asking about one of his sons. In her answer to Mordecai, Esther gives us another problem that she had to deal with. This is in the 4th chapter, verse 11. It says, all the king's servants in all the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king into the inner court who is not called, there is one law of his to put him to death. except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter that he may live. But I have not been called to come in unto the king these 30 days. Well, here was Esther's dilemma. And here begins her action of faith. By going to the king without being called, she risked certain death. The fact that the king had not called her for 30 days seems to suggest to her that she didn't have as much influence as she thought she needed to have to get such a big favor from him. Well, how should faith read those circumstances? Brethren, how would you read them if you were in Esther's place? You know, I think there's a fine, important point here on the working of faith. Some might reason that, well, there was no absolute clear indication from the Lord that Esther should do anything. So she should just sit and wait, do nothing, until the Lord made it perfectly clear. But read what Mordecai says to her in verses 13 and 14. Then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, "Think not with thyself as thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Well, Esther understood Mordecai's logic. She was a Jew. The decree made no exceptions, whether queen or not. She was still a Jew. And so she was at risk. But the point was, she could have put it off. She didn't have to go into the lion's den seeking something that would cost her life immediately, or that could cost her life. I think Mordecai put his finger on it when he said, "Who knows whether you've been brought to this point for this very reason?" From that exchange with Mordecai, Esther's response was positive. But she asked all the Jews to join together with her for prayer and fasting for 3 days. And that's an important lesson when trying to determine the Lord's will. Go to him in prayer. Seek his counsel. Ask others for help. Ask others to go to the Lord for direction as well. It's a crucial point in the working of faith. Don't just sit and do nothing. Go to the Heavenly Father and look for his will. At the end of those 3 days, she puts a plan into motion. But again, brethren, what convinced her that this was the Lord's will for her to do? Was it just that Mordecai talked her into it? I don't think so. The fine point of faith that I mentioned earlier, I think, is this. There are times in our lives when something is clearly the Lord's will. Maybe there's a scripture that is right on the point. Or maybe there's some clear providences that show us this is really the Lord's will. It's clear in my mind. And in those cases of clear direction, I believe we should run boldly ahead. As they say, we're to take the bull by the horns and show our zeal and determination to do what the Lord wants us to do. In these situations, we're to be aggressive in pursuing the accomplishment of whatever that is. That's what zeal is all about. It's burning and consuming our energies in the accomplishment of the Lord's will. But on the other hand, when the Lord's directions are not precisely clear, when his providences are not black and white, when we're in a position that something has to be done, faith should tread more carefully. Faith should move ahead, but it should move ahead reservedly. You know, it's like comparing how you might walk through a minefield with how you might just run on an open paved road. Not being sure of the Lord's will is like walking through a minefield. There are dangers that you may step on. Mordecai and Esther had to proceed. They sought the Lord's direction. They analyzed the situation. They saw the possibility that the Lord's providence had put Esther in that position for that very reason. But you know, there was still a large measure of uncertainty in what they were going to do. When faith has to move without clear directions, it moves carefully. And it's always ready to change directions when shown the Lord's leadings. It's like listening to that voice behind thee saying, "No, this is the way," and you have to be willing to change and follow that voice behind you. You know, as we look at the story of Esther and Mordecai, we have a wonderful bird's eye view, don't we? We can stand back, we see the beginning of the story, the middle of the story, the end of the story, and it's clean cut. But Esther and Mordecai didn't have that advantage. They were right in the middle of it. In answer to Mordecai, Esther says at the end of verse 16 of the fourth chapter, she says, "So will I go in unto the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish." She was willing to put her life on the line now. She wasn't going to wait. She was willing to die for her people. She understood the logic of Mordecai that if she didn't do it now, she probably would die in 11 months. But still, brethren, it would have been easier for her to put it off, to hope that maybe there was another answer, that she didn't have to risk herself. If her faith was unfounded, she would die. But she really wanted to save her people. It was really a burden on her heart. You know something, brethren? Even if Mordecai and Esther had misread this whole experience, I believe the Lord would have been pleased with that faith, with that exercise of courage, with that desire to be helpful, with that desire to put themselves in the line for the good of others. So even if they were wrong, that this wasn't the Lord's will, I'm sure the Lord would have blessed them. And I'm sure he would have worked out something else. After the 3 days of fasting, Esther puts on her royal apparel. She goes into the inner court of the palace where the king sat on his throne. Let's read chapter 5, verse 2. "And so it was when the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court, that she obtained favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. So Esther drew near and touched the top of his scepter. Then said the king unto her, 'What wilt thou, Queen Esther, and what is thy request? It shall be even given to thee to half the kingdom.' And Esther answered, 'If it seem good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto the banquet that I have prepared for him.'" Well, brethren, the Lord knew how to direct Esther. He knew what would influence Ahasuerus, and I think it was the beauty of Esther. In fact, I wouldn't doubt that the Lord brought into Ahasuerus' mind the difference between this young, simple girl who came to him without being called at the risk of her own life, while his previous queen refused to come even when she was commanded. Seeing the contrast in the demeanor of the two queens brought instant favor to Esther just as quickly as it brought instant disfavor to Vashti. I think it was refreshing for the king to see such courage in such a young person when he was probably used to everyone being terrified of him, that when he came, everyone took a step back or turned the other way or avoided him. Here was someone who came face to face with him in courage. Well, that day the king and Haman attended the banquet prepared by Esther, and the king again asked her, "What do you want?" And her answer was that she wanted the king and Haman to come to another feast that she was preparing on the following day. You know, it was a well-thought-out plan. It took into consideration the temperament of Ahasuerus, realizing that if he ever felt the slightest hint that she was trying to trick him, she knew what had happened to the man with the five sons. These banquets were to win him over, to gain his appreciation. Esther and Mordecai, who I think devised the plan together, considered the recipient of the request before making a difficult request. And you know, there's a lot of wisdom in that, in your own experiences. When you're in the difficult situation that you have to go to someone, consider the temperament of the person you're going to. You know, it's easy to go to someone who is carefree and is not uptight about things, but when you're going to someone who's a little more strict, who's a little tougher, who's going to be a little more critical, be more careful. Consider that person. It's not false to do that. I think there's wisdom in doing that. But you know, after that first banquet, Haman was really excited. He thought, "Boy, I've really made it in this kingdom. Here the queen is throwing a feast for me, and it's just me and the king and the queen. I'm really happy with myself." And you know, he goes home, he tells his wife, he calls all his friends, and he's just excited about the whole thing. But you know something? In almost the same breath, when he's talking about how pleased he is, he says, "But I can never be content as long as Mordecai is still alive. Brethren, tell me what that has to do with his joy. I can't understand how he could think about his hatred for Mordecai when he's rejoicing about being honored by Esther and Ahasuerus. But it shows that hatred can poison everything in a person's life. It can ruin even the good things that we enjoy. Haman's hatred was to ruin not only his life, but his whole family's life as well. Seeing the hatred that was in him, his wife thought she had a great therapeutic suggestion. She says, well, why don't you go start building a gallows for Mordecai right now? And he did that. He started on it immediately. And he was pleased with that idea. Another turning point in the story, one that again, obviously was overruled by the Lord, occurred in the 6th chapter. This is my favorite part of the book. Let's read verse 1. Notice the incredible timing of this event. This is the same night that Haman is building the gallows for Mordecai. 6:1. On that night could not the king sleep, and he commanded to bring the book of records of the chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's chamberlains, the keepers of the door, who sought to lay hands on the king Ahasuerus. And the king said, what honor and dignity have been done to Mordecai for this? Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, there is nothing done for him. And the king said, who is in the court? Now Haman was in the court, was come into the outer court of the king's house to speak unto the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. Well, brethren, we can see where the Lord's taking this, can't we? You couldn't write a Hollywood script that was more dramatic than what was happening right here. Did it just so happen that Ahasuerus couldn't sleep that night? The same night that Haman had prepared the gallows for Mordecai? Did it just so happen that he wanted to have his chronicles read to him? Did it just so happen that the specific event about Mordecai was read? And did it just so happen that Haman was in the court waiting to speak to the king about killing Mordecai? These show all the behind-the-scenes workings of the Lord, the secret workings of the Lord. And it shows that his overrulings are often out of our sight, but they are there. That's why he's given us stories like this, like Esther and Joseph, to show that he works behind the scenes for our good, for the deliverance of his people. You know, brethren, our victories, when they come, as I was saying, are attached to the Lord working behind the scenes. But our victories are not accomplished by God alone. And I think that's one of the points of this entire story, to show us that faith works with God's providences. God's will alone is often accomplished through the faith of his people. You can't always sit back and expect God to do everything for us. Just as Mordecai said to Esther, if you don't do what is in your hand to do, then the Lord will raise someone else. After being reminded of what Mordecai had done for him, Ahasuerus calls in Haman. And without naming any names, he asks Haman what the king should do for a man that he wants to honor. And of course, Haman thinks that he's talking about him because he had been honored already. So Haman answers that the king should put his royal apparel on him, he should put his crown on him, he should have a noble parade him around the city on the king's horse, proclaiming that this is one greatly honored by the king. And then the truth drops like a hammer. Ahasuerus tells Haman to hurry and make all the arrangements, and you personally go and honor Mordecai. It's almost poetic justice, isn't it? Can you imagine the look on Haman's face? Can you imagine the blood drawing and his face turning white? Excuse me. Can you imagine what thoughts raced through his mind? In chapter 6, verse 12, we're told that after Haman finished the honoring of Mordecai through the city, he hurried into his house in mourning, having his head covered. He was humiliated by the whole experience. His arrogance had been thrown back into his face. He was forced to honor the very man that he planned and was in the court to kill. Haman again gives us the lesson of jealousy and hatred and how bitter the fruits of those things are. They lead only to shame and dishonor. Brethren, we really need to be on the lookout for those things, even in small ways, because even small hatred, small jealousy, small rivalry has no good fruit. It has only evil fruit. So when you see even the roots of them, they must be taken out of our hearts. In the next scene, we see Ahasuerus and Haman at the second banquet of Esther. And here the king finally found out what Esther really wanted. But notice how sincerely she reveals her thoughts. This is chapter 7, verses 3 and 4. It says, "Then Esther the queen answered and said, 'If I have found favor in thy sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. If we had been sold for bondsmen and bondswomen, I had held my tongue, although the enemy could not countervail the king's damage.'" Esther shows the king that this was a desperate situation. This was not just a simple request to have one son be released from military service. She said that if it would have just been a matter of being sold into slavery, I would have said nothing. But this is bigger than that. This is genocide. This is the murder of an entire race of people, and I can't be quiet for that. And I was willing to risk my life for that. Ahasuerus still didn't know what Esther was talking about. He asks her, who would do such a thing? And she finally reveals, "The man sitting at the banquet table with you is the one who has formed this plot." That's why she had Haman there, because she didn't want Haman to have the opportunity to privately convince the king that what she was saying wasn't true. Brethren, this was a 15-year-old girl who was trying to drive a wedge between the two most powerful men in the world. You know what her weapons were? Sincerity and truth. If you ever have a battle to fight, brethren, those are the most powerful weapons that you can ever use. Sincerity and truth. And your courage can be from the Lord. Your faith in Him, that He will strengthen you. Well, I must be talking slower than I normally talk, but we have quite a bit more. Well, anyway, Ahasuerus was shocked, and as you might guess, so was Haman. Haman apparently didn't even know that Esther was Jewish, and apparently didn't know that she was even related to Mordecai. The king then goes out into the garden to think about this, and when he left, Haman falls on Esther's couch, begging for his life. The self-satisfaction of what he had felt earlier and his being honored was now crumbling in a web that he had formed himself. As Haman pleads with Esther, Ahasuerus comes back in, and he sees Haman laying on Esther's couch. And in his anger, he jumps to a ridiculous conclusion. He jumps to the conclusion that Haman is trying to seduce Esther. Now, if he wasn't sure what to do before, this jumping to this conclusion made it clear Haman had to die. Again, that's such an unreasonable jump of a conclusion, but that's what it was. I think it kind of shows you a little bit of the character of Ahasuerus, of how impetuous he was, and how temperament he was, temper-filled he was. Well, he ordered that Haman be hung on the same gallows that he had built for Mordecai. But brethren, how did Ahasuerus know that Haman had built a gallows for Mordecai? Well, I think, guessing, that it was the same men who had read the chronicles to him earlier. Those men who were chamberlains of the king undoubtedly knew and loved and respected Mordecai. And when they were given the opportunity to read the chronicles to Ahasuerus, do you think they just flippantly opened anywhere? Absolutely not. They opened to the page that vindicated Mordecai and showed his goodness. Well, here's a case, brethren, where truth is stranger than fiction. The cunning of Haman in getting Ahasuerus to issue a decree against the Jews cost him his own life. The contrast between Haman and Esther makes me think of that beautiful phrase in the morning resolve that says, I will strive to be simple and sincere towards all. Simplicity and sincerity are, to me, a good description of the character of Esther. It's those qualities, I believe, that won the king's heart. But in Haman, we see the opposite. We see a case of complexity and insincerity, and those things just weaved a tangled mess that eventually cost him his life. The decree of killing the Jews had to stand. You remember the law of the Medes and the Persians couldn't be changed even by the king. It was the same law that threw Daniel in the lion's den, even though the king loved Daniel and didn't want to do it. The law was made. It had to be carried out. In the story of Daniel, the Lord overruled the law of men. We need to remember these experiences, brethren, and try to relate them to our own life. Have you ever experienced the law of the Medes and the Persians? What I mean by that is, have you ever been in a situation where you thought that there was absolutely no way out, there was no solution, there was no answer, there was no way anyone could fix this problem? Well, the answer is that with the Lord, there is always a solution. His hand is not short. Faith recognizes that and trusts and rests itself on that fact. There is always a solution because God is on our side. He can even untangle the law of the Medes and Persians that come into our lives from time to time. Faith trusts in that and rests itself on that. So if you ever have the experience of thinking that there's a situation in your life that can't possibly be resolved properly and to a blessing to you, think again, because the Lord's hand is never short. He can overrule that law. The solution for Esther and Mordecai was to issue a second decree, proclaiming that the Jews would be allowed to defend themselves against anyone who tried to carry out the first decree. And it was made very clear that the second decree came from someone who could back it up with power and authority. Where was Haman? What good was his decree if Haman had been hanged on the gallows by the king? Kind of gives you a subtle message there, doesn't it? If you were a citizen of the Medo-Persian Empire and you heard these two decrees come out of the palace, you would be confused. What is going on in there? But you know what you wouldn't be confused about? Which decree to obey. Haman had been hung. Where was he? But Mordecai's decree stood, and Mordecai had been elevated into the position that Haman once held. As a matter of fact, if you look at verse 8, if you look at the last verse of chapter 8, we're told that many of the people of the land became Jews, for fear of the Jews fell upon them. Now, it's difficult for me to imagine that they became very devout Jews. But nevertheless, they became supporters rather than enemies of the Jews. Brethren, isn't it remarkable how Haman's decree to exterminate the Jews in the end created converts to Judaism? It just shows you how the Lord can take the evil intents of anyone and turn them around for great blessings. It's like that scripture in Psalm that says, how's it going now? My mind went blank. Remember that one about restraining evil? I forget how it goes. Anyway, that's what I get for ad-libbing. The hand of the Lord is not short. His wisdom is incredible when we look at how this series of events was turned around. Not only was Haman killed, but his wealth was given to Esther, and Mordecai was made chief counselor to Ahasuerus in Haman's place. Mordecai was put in a position of power in many ways greater than even Esther's. The people saw the decree, and they stood. Mordecai's decree was the one that stood out as the obvious one to accept. Well, the lesson of this victory is that the rewards of faith, I'll just wrap it up here because I know my time is up, are as sure as the Lord is true. And Mordecai and Esther are a wonderful example of that. Brother, may the Lord add his blessing, and may we follow the examples of those who have gone before us and even try to set ourselves up as role models for future generations in the truth. May he add his blessings.
Thank you, Brother Tom. Very inspiring talk. And it's a real good start to this convention. And we expect more to follow.
and have only a short intermission. So we were obliged to see that this terminated on time. The closing hymn that the brothers chose is 197, but we'll only sing one verse, and then Brother Tom will close with prayer.
Dear Father, we thank you for the privilege of being together in this day of convention. We thank you for the examples of faith, the many examples that you have given to us. Father, help us to realize the importance of not only knowing the examples, but living them in our lives. Help us to be examples for future generations, Father, that our lives of faith may be a glory and honor to thee, for that is our purpose and goal. We thank you for the truth and the common bond that we have together. Especially we thank you for the merit of thy Son that gives us standing before thee. We pray in Jesus' precious name. Amen.
We have only a 12-minute intermission, so keep that in mind.